Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I am Ben Rhodes, and Tommy is out today because he is out promoting his new book, Democracy or Else, How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps, just 10 of them. It is out now. That means you can get it in your bookstores. I'm very appreciative of how people who listen to this podcast have been supportive of my books in the past, helped me get on the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list twice. Not that this is a competition. It's not, because I actually want them to get on the New York Times bestseller list as well. I want them to get their book out in the world. And so I just do want to tell people I've read the book. I'm in the book, a little cameo appearance, but it's a funny, practical guide to American democracy. It's basically like Pod Save America in a book. It's got a lot of advice from the guys over 7 years of podcasting and years in politics before that. It brings in perspectives from some really smart people. It has some cool illustrations. It's got plenty of jokes, of course. So it's a fun ride. And you can get a copy of Democracy or Else now, wherever books are sold. You can order it online, pick it up. It's perfect for the season. The season, of course, being our crazy campaign. And that leads me into the fact that we all know the presidential debate is coming up. It's tomorrow night, Thursday night. Our daily news podcast on Crooked What a Day just released an episode on what goes into debate prep and the debate prep process, what to expect for the debate night. So to listen, head to the What a Day feed now. I love those guys. I love being on What a Day myself. And if you want a recap of the Trump-Biden face-off, they are also going to be releasing a post-debate episode the morning after on What a Day. So make sure to subscribe to What a Day wherever you get your podcast. We have a great show for you today. I've got a tremendous guest co-host, my friend David Lammy, British Member of Parliament, Shadow Foreign Secretary. And if all goes according to plan on July 4th with the British election, David could be the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom next time we hear from him. I'll also be talking to Ed Wong, who is the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Truly remarkable book that deals with Ed's personal family history, his father's past service in the People's Liberation Army under Mao Zedong, and how that helped shape his experience and Ed's family experience. But also, Ed was the diplomatic correspondent from 2008 to 2016, incredibly consequential decade in China. He covered all the main stories from the Olympics to the Hong Kong protest movement to the situation with the Uyghurs. He traveled out to Xinjiang province. And so Ed really reckons in this book with how China's changed from his father's time to now, what it means for world politics. So stick around for that interview as well. But first, let me welcome my friend David Lammy to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on the pod. It's great to be with you.
Well, this is exciting. We are in the home stretch of a campaign that feels much happier, David, than a lot of the campaigns happening around the world. we have just over a week till July 4th, an interesting choice by Rishi Sunak. It's not necessarily been a good date for British prime ministers in the past. But that's when the election will be held in the UK. We've been talking about this a lot. The stakes, of course, are high. The Labour Party could take power back from the Conservatives for the first time since 1997. Before we get into, you know, the campaign and the issues, David, I just want to ask you, how are you doing? Like, how are you feeling right now, just over a week out?
Well, look, you know, this is my eighth general election. This last weekend passed. I'll have been in politics for 24 years. And the truth is, if you're a Labour politician that's been around a while, you get used to losing elections, not winning elections. And in fact, we forget sometimes the Labour Party was only in power in the 20th century for 23 years. We won under Clem Attlee after the Second World War. We won under Harold Wilson. And we won under Tony Blair. That's it. So if we pull this off, it's a staggering victory for Keir Starmer. And I say that because it's important to understand that the Labour Party at the last general election in 2019 suffered its worst defeat since 1935. And so to pull off the rebound in just one electoral cycle is a huge, huge, huge momentous moment, that with all credit to Keir Starmer for the way he's changed the party around and reorientated it towards the electorate.
All right. So wait, that's a perfect segue. And you didn't even know I was going to do this, but you came on this podcast after that Boris Johnson landslide in 2019.
Did I?
everybody was super depressed. It felt like the Tories are going to be in power forever. And I asked you, what does the Labour Party need to do to recover from this absolute wipeout? And I'm going to play a clip of what you said. Here we go.
What do you think is next for the Labour Party? And how would you like to see the Labour Party evolve to have a better shot in the next election?
My view is the first thing is we must elect a leader that looks like he or she is capable of being prime minister on day one. And that is absolutely mandatory. And that means that not just a leader that makes the Labour fold and those on the centre-left and left feel good about themselves, but someone who the country can look at and instantly say, yes, I can put my faith in that man or woman.
I mean, not to give you credit here, David, because the election hasn't happened yet. But so shortly after that, you told me that the guy you were backing was Keir Starmer. What was the, right now, again, I know we're all terrified until the election happens, and we need to be because, as you point out, Labour has history of losing. I'm a Democrat, so I get my heart broken a lot here. But the polling, has you up about 20 points. Tell me, just before we get into this campaign, what happened over the last 5 years that put you guys in this position? Obviously, the Tories, lit themselves on fire repeatedly, and we'll talk about some of that here. But what is the difference between the Labour Party today and when you told me that comment about needing to find a leader that can be prime minister on day one, right after Boris Johnson just kind of wiped you guys out?
Keir Starmer is a bright, seriously educated. He was a phenomenal lawyer before he came into politics. He came into politics relatively late in 2015. He definitely crossed that threshold of someone who looks like a prime minister. The big question was actually not whether he looked like a prime minister, it's whether he could lead the Labour Party and change the Labour Party. And of course, he came into office dealing with the pandemic first off, so he could not even get out of his home for the first stages of his leadership. But when he got out of his home, he was determined to deal with the problems we had around anti-Semitism. He was determined to reorientate the party to look at the country. And that meant that there were things that the party were wedded to that got thrown out because they weren't priorities for the country. He was determined not to fight the sort of the cancel culture stuff, the woke stuff and all of that, but to stay in the mainstream and in the UK electoral cycle. It's about the economy, stupid. It's about public services, people's schools, the state of our National Health Service, crime on our streets, right in the centre ground, bold on climate. But the biggest thing was just changing the party. And convincing the electorate that if you can change the party, actually, let's give this guy another opportunity to change the country. So he did that. And then he allowed the Conservative Party to self-combust. And some politicians want to always get into the action. Sometimes if your opponents are pulling themselves apart, sit back and watch. Let them pull themselves apart. That political judgment that's required, he showed in huge quantum. So, I co-chaired his campaign to become the leader of the Labour Party. He had to be selected. There was a contest. And I warned him to set himself, don't be too ambitious. I said, set yourself a 10-year cycle. You might just lose the next election and then you can go again. He disagreed with me. He said, no, I can do this in 5. He proved himself right. So, if he wins on July the 4th, he will have a huge opportunity to take his mandate, I think, into the country, because this will be written up as one of the biggest comeback stories in electoral history.
So I want to ask you about the right, the Tories, because as you've said, one of the things that Starmer and you and the Labour Party have done is kind of really claimed the centre. And part of that's because of the changes you've made to the party. Part of that's because, Boris Johnson had to resign in somewhat disgrace because of, lying and COVID parties and just general, Boris Johnson vibes. Liz Truss almost tanked the Bank of England in a few days. Rishi Sunak, I mean, last week we were covering this D-Day fiasco. He hasn't really had any vision for the country. And so, you know, some of these polls have the Tories only winning as few as like around 100 seats. Now, people need to bear in mind, this is in a 650-seat House of Commons, the party that has completely dominated British politics for most of the last, you know, say, at least 150 years. The question I would ask you, though, is that part of what's happening is more than half the people who voted for the Tories in the last election are saying they plan to vote for a different party. Some of that's going to Labour, but some of that's going to Nigel Farage, who's thrown his hat in the ring. And the Reform Party is just a few points behind the Tories now in some of these polls. And I just want to ask you, how do you see the British right now? On the one hand, you know, we're all probably glad to see the Tories facing accountability. And frankly, in a way that this is my words, not yours, the American Republican Party has avoided here. But also, it's a little concerning to see Nigel Farage getting any support anywhere. What do you anticipate in terms of the British right, and how should we across the pond here look at whatever traction Nigel Farage is getting? Is he trolling the Tory party? Does he have a real chance of kind of taking over the British right, maybe even using this as a platform to try to take over some leadership of the Tory party?
There are a number of things to say on this front, Ben. The first thing to say is that we are in a cycle in our politics, and this is the same across Western democracies. It's something that we see in the United States and certainly see in the United Kingdom and across Europe. It's important to emphasize, which is a cycle that effectively began in 2008 with the huge banking crisis. And your old boss inherited this problem big time. We're still in the same cycle. It's an economic cycle in which significant parts of the traditional, sometimes in America, it's called the Rust Belt or the Sun Belt. Here in the UK, it's often parts of the old industrial north, our seaside towns, significant working families really struggling economically, seeing their jobs lost and other things. And against that backdrop, we have a polarized politics driven by social media. And definitely we've seen in the United Kingdom politics on the extreme left and politics on the extreme right. I don't think that pendulum's changed. And if you're in a Western democracy, it's still with us. And clearly, as a progressive, it's something of huge concern coming from the right. In our electoral cycle in 2019, there was a huge focus on Jeremy Corbyn, and the left in the British system, far less focus on what was happening to the Conservative Party under Boris Johnson. Well, that genie is most definitely out of the bottle. And, you know, what the truth is that populists never deliver. Not really. The rhetoric is there. The empathetic tone is there for some of those communities that's attractive. But the delivery, oh my God, the delivery is something else. And that has come home to roost. And whatever I might have said or my views about Margaret Thatcher, I would simply not have been able to suggest that she'd achieved nothing in her years in office. She'd achieved a huge amount, even though I disagreed with it. You might have disagreed with some of it. Here we've got a bunch of folk. They've achieved nothing, effectively nothing that they can point to the electorate, apart from these manufactured rows that they create around cancel culture and woke type issues. That is significant. I think it's also true to say that even where the Conservatives were running on a compassionate Conservative agenda under David Cameron and George Osborne back in the early noughties, they were struggling to get over that threshold to actually form a government. That's why they were in coalition with the Liberal Democrats in our system. So I do think that there's a crisis for them on the right. The instinct, I suspect, will be to swing towards Reform and to Nigel Farage if they don't win the general election next week. Generally speaking, politics is fought on the centre ground, and parties that give up the centre ground do not win office. That was our experience back in 2019 and just before that. And I'm afraid, let's see where the Conservatives find themselves. But I have to caveat that because we are seeing a trend in Europe where these parties are winning, but they tend to win by jettisoning policies that feel too extreme. And that's the experience in Italy. And actually, we're seeing some of that evidence with Le Pen in France. So I haven't got a crystal ball, but it is extraordinary to be in a situation where Nigel Farage's Reform Party is outperforming in the polls the traditional Conservative Party. And if parties don't attend to delivery, then they can end up extinct, is the truth. And that was what the Labour Party was facing, thank God. Keir Starmer particularly gripped this and took us back into a mainstream centre direction.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary in the sense that the Tories, other than Brexit, right, they did nothing with this, you know, successive mandates, other than a lot of austerity that, you know, hurt a lot of people, and then a lot of chaos, and then a lot of, you know, woke cancel culture stuff. But there's a seriousness to it. The one scandal I wanted to tap into today, because, you know, we can pick from a lot of choices with the Tories, is this new betting scandal, where, for people who have been following this, there are reports that several people in Rishi Sunak's circle placed bets on the date of the general election. Now, again, for Americans, the prime minister kind of calls the timing of the election. So if you were, you know, wanted to lay a bet on something and you knew about this, you could obviously make some money off this. I'm going to play a clip from Sunak responding to this, and then I want to just frame it in a question for you. But let's hear Rishi Sunak, who's been having a great couple of weeks here between skipping D-Day and now this. Let's hear Rishi Sunak responding to this betting scandal.
I was incredibly angry when I learned about these allegations, in the same anger that many of you will feel and everyone watching. And it's right that they are investigated thoroughly. These are serious allegations.
The question I have here is that this can seem like kind of a small thing, but actually to me, it's the whole ball game, in the sense that politics is just for sport. It's just for personal gain. It's the same reason that, I'm sorry to answer my own question here, but like Boris Johnson having parties in number 10 at the same time he's telling people they can't go out. Rishi Sunak would rather fly back to London to do an interview than be there with D-Day veterans. Now he's got people betting on the date of the election. And the serious question I want to ask you is, it feels like there must be a kind of a crisis of, do people trust institutions? Do people trust politicians? If you are able to win, apart from kind of being able to beat these people, what can you do to kind of rebuild a sense that actually government and politics is supposed to work for people when there's been such kind of disregard for that kind of trust?
It saddens me to have to say this in a very cynical political environment. But in the end, if politics isn't about service and public service, we're finished. And democracy is desperately, desperately undermined. Of course, politics throws up the occasional scandal, the occasional resignation. But let's remember that what this crisis, I think, that's gripping the Conservative Party underlines is the terribly low moral standards set by Boris Johnson and his partying while people died. And by the way, the correct behaviour was epitomised by the late Queen, who sat on her own when her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, had passed away. Boris Johnson's number 10 were partying on that very, very day. It's also evokes, we had some real scandals around procurement during the pandemic and the way in which contracts were given to friends of ministers in a way that really attracted very little accountability and very little transparency. Rishi Sunak promised integrity, professionalism, and accountability. Instead, what I'm afraid what we got was incredible weakness. And I think that on the back of D-Day, as you said, poor judgment, but this venal sense that actually money is to be made on the date of the election. And it indicates a way in which those in representative office have entirely lost touch with the sanctity of the role that comes with politics and the degree of integrity that's required when you have the privilege of being in the know about, for example, when an election day is called.
So now I want to get into issues, and most of this we'll spend on foreign policy, which has emerged as your portfolio. But just one question on, you know, you'll be coming in, you know, dealing with a lot of challenges, right? The NHS, National Health Service, has got huge shortages. Austerity budgets have kind of gutted social services. There's not a lot of revenue coming in. Brexit's created problems. What is the big program that you guys are campaigning on? Like, how would you want to be judged for success in your first year in office? What do you have to get done as your key kind of domestic and economic program? And then we'll get into foreign policy.
Well, it's growth. The UK is going to struggle unless we get back to growth. That takes a reorientation. And clearly, we need economic stability. And it's extraordinary to have to say that that's what we need. But after Liz Truss, and to some extent, Rishi Sunak, because our economy is still in a terrible place, the highest taxes people have ever faced in 70 years, and no growth or slow growth, we have to get back to stability and growth. A bit like you saw with Joe Biden, a reorientation towards facing the climate emergency, that race on the net zero challenge that we have is hugely important to our economy. And that has been center stage of one of our propositions. We want to be fiscally responsible and sensible. So we have indicated in our manifesto the areas where we will raise taxes. We're going to change the situation for what we call people who are non-domiciled in the UK. They're basically internationals not paying tax. We're going to change that arrangement and use that money, particularly in areas of the health service. And we're making some changes to the way that our schools that are not our state public schools, but our private schools have had certain tax breaks in order to raise money for the majority of young people, the 94% of young people in our state education system. These are important changes. We need 6,500 teachers, for example, that we're going to get from that small change. So propositions that rebuild trust in relation to our public services, with the NHS, huge waiting lists for people if they need cancer treatment or even if they just want to, you know, see primary care. Progress in our schools. But in the end, you can only do it if you are fiscally responsible and you get back growth. Part of that growth, of course, is in our relationship with the international community. And I'm looking forward to being in India, where I hope we will side that trade deal with the Indians over this next period. And they seem very keen to do that. We want to mend fences with our friends in Europe. You know, we had this bitter divorce led, if you like, by Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. We're not going back into the European Union, but there's going to be a reset on the tone. And we're offering the European Union a security pact based on, of course, defense, but energy, climate, a whole range of issues that they care about. And we want to strike a different arrangement to the one that Boris Johnson struck on the trade arrangement that he set with them. So all of that will give us stability and growth. That is how we will be judged in 5 years' time.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Save big money on your next painting project at Menards. Pristine interior paint and primer in one is Dutch Boy's best hiding and most durable paint. It delivers a smooth, elegant finish while providing maximum scuff, stain, and mark resistance. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and get your painting project started today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, so now I want to go into foreign policy and starting with kind of your general vision and then take you around the world to some of the key hotspots. You laid out, I think, a good summary of your worldview in foreign affairs a few weeks ago, a piece called The Case for Progressive Realism. I like that. That's a good term. I my own piece in foreign affairs the other day was very much in line with that that theory of the case. You know, we need to be real about the world as it is. I want to just ask you to start, what would stay the same in British foreign policy and what would change in British foreign policy, broadly speaking, under a Labour government? I know there's some things where you want to signal consistency and then there's some areas where you want to take a different course. How would you sum up the what stays the same and what changes?
Well, there's going to be a reset on Europe. There's going to be a reset on climate, for sure. And there's going to be a reset, frankly, on our relations with the global South, particularly in some of those middle power nations where this business of meeting the world as it is, not as we would like it to be, is very important. And not talking down, patronizing, and being just downright rude to folk like Boris Johnson was prepared to be. Extraordinary. All of that will go. Ben, I think your listeners don't underestimate how important those resets I've set are there. And then there's got to be a gear shift. And the gear shift has got to be on economic growth and economic diplomacy, I think, is hugely important. Hence what I'm indicating with India, countries in the Gulf, potentially the United States and the EU is very, very important. Just a different approach, particularly on areas like climate. And then, obviously, on the security piece, with war in Europe and real problems in the Middle East, we have been crystal clear in our support for Ukraine and crystal clear in our longstanding commitment to a two-state solution, particularly to a ceasefire in Gaza and in that crisis, and to doing all that we can to bring peace and stability to the Middle East. So that's quite a different template to the one that we've been on in the last few years here in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like in watching you, and I guess I'll go to Ukraine first here, and we'll come back to Gaza, of course, but on Ukraine, I think you guys have tried to signal, you know, we may be a left to center party, but we are in, you know, there's a kind of British mainstream that is supportive of Ukraine, that is invested in Ukraine, that has generally been more forward leaning than other European countries in providing certain weapon systems to Ukraine. We're at a place now where if you guys take power, the war's, you know, a stalemate, if not trending negatively for the Ukrainians on the front line. You've had Zelensky asking for less restrictions on weapons. more systems, obviously. It was hard to get that package of assistance out of the U.S. Congress recently. I do want to note that while the British mainstream has been supportive of Ukraine, Nigel Farage, who, as you said, is kind of making a move to be the kind of leader of the right, has sounded a little bit more like, you know, the Trump wing of the Republican Party on Ukraine recently. I just want to play a clip about of Farage recently talking about Ukraine with the BBC.
When Vladimir Putin sent his troops across the border in 22, you blamed the West, not him. You said, I'll just read it to you and then you can react, that on a tweet, it was a consequence of EU and NATO expansion. Is that a judgment you stand by?
Right. I'll tell you what you don't know. I stood up in the European Parliament in 2014 and I said, and I quote, there will be a war in Ukraine. Why did I say that? It was obvious to me that the ever eastward expansion of NATO and the European Union was giving this man a reason to his Russian people to say they're coming for us again and to go to war.
But you were echoing him.
I was, sorry?
You were echoing him. That's what Putin says.
No. Sorry, I've been saying this actually since the 1990s. Ever since yeah. Well, the
so
fall of the wall. But hang on a second. We've provoked this war. It's, you know, of course it's his fault. He's used what
we've
done
as an excuse. But we provoked the invasion of
Ukraine. Yes, and very interestingly, once again, 10 years ago when I predicted this, by the way, I'm the only person in British politics that predicted what would happen.
I don't agree with Nigel Farage at all, but we can't dismiss entirely a populist view that is gaining traction, right, in Europe and the US. And as there's fatigue with cost of living issues, my question for you is, if you guys come into power, one, how do you deal with the politics of Ukraine so that in Europe, in the US, in the UK, we're able to sustain what could be, you know, pretty costly support going forward? And then what is your message to the Ukrainians? What is a Labour government saying? I mean, you saw Zelensky in Normandy. I imagine you had the chance to talk to him and Keir Starmer did. What's your message to the Ukrainians about what a Labour government will do on Ukraine?
Well, look, let me just start with that Farage statement, which I think is just utterly, utterly appalling. Yeah. And, you know, there's this horrible thing that we see historically where characters like Farage have some sort of relationship with authoritarianism and the brutality that sits behind that, this kind of horrendous big man politics, where he seems more comfortable being a defender and speaking for the Kremlin than he does for his own people. And for me, the compass is really simple, and all of the evidence is the British people are in a similar place. Either freedom, and the freedom we enjoy, Ben, you and I, to have this conversation and the majority of listeners, either that's something worth fighting for, or we're happy to allow Putin the kind of new fascism that he's displaying. And I think it's just horrendous when you think of the thousands of lives that have been lost in Ukraine since 2014, because for them, this story began in 2014, to sort of concede that ground and say somehow it was provoked by us. You know, in the end, when I go to Ukraine, and I've now been many, many times before this crisis, what I see is a group of people who want their own autonomy and those that freedom. And I think it is entirely wrong to live in a world where we allow big powers to start redrawing the map for their small neighbors. So that degree of self-determination that I think is just vital in any democracy, I think we've got to stand for. Look, we've now got, Ukraine, the funds are coming through. It has been tough over the last little while. But I think it can improve considerably over the next few months, particularly with the air defenses that the Ukrainians are asking for. If we come out of this election over the line, I will attend NATO with Keir Starmer and our defense lead in DC, and the unity that we need coming out of that is going to be hugely, hugely important. It's been really important for us here in the UK Labour Party not to play politics with this serious issue, not to be partisan with this serious issue. And, every time I've been in DC, and I've been in DC with you, Ben, I've wanted to deliver that message to Democrats and Republicans alike. I don't say this is easy, but I say, what is the choice? And where will this end? If we give up on Ukraine, where will this end? When we remember the story, the horrific story of the 1930s in Europe, and what happens when you concede to authoritarianism. So the truth is that combined NATO, by the way, which is a Labour Party inheritance, it's the work of Clem Attlee and Nye Bevin that gave us NATO. If we combine, I think we can demonstrate to Putin that we are there for the long haul. And it's that that will bring him to the table of negotiation and ultimately realizing that he cannot continue down this path.
And, you know, part of what you need to do is kind of fortify Ukraine for negotiation and for long-term success. Their, you know, we all know their preferred option would be to join NATO, right? When you go to that NATO summit, when you look at the range of options of things that can reassure the Ukrainians, you know, additional weapon systems, long-term support, the nature of their relationship with NATO and security guarantees, they obviously want to be a member of the EU. That's on the table too. Where do you guys come down on things like their relationship with NATO, or what can be done to provide that signal of long-term support beyond just kind of churning out, you know, frontline military assistance?
Look, I understand the desire of Ukraine. I think that we can reach a language and a communique coming out of NATO that we can all agree upon. They will need guarantees, but we have to be serious also about Article 5 and what that means for all partners, and most definitely the United States, and we have to be ready for that. So I'm confident that we can reach a language. We here in the UK have been, you know, out in front, frankly, in support of Ukraine, and we will continue to be that if there is to be a change of government. But I think the most important thing is to remain a united posture after a period where there have been differences. And we've got to be careful not to allow Putin particularly to capitalize on that. And, you know, we haven't spoken about his trip in the last few days to North Korea. It's really interesting. Yeah. The South Koreans were providing more shells to Ukraine than the whole of Europe combined when I was recently looking at the figures. And there is Putin in an alliance that is deeply, deeply worrying. And so my bottom line is that we come out of NATO in a unified position that is sustained through the election cycle, particularly that we're going to see in the United States.
And moving to Gaza here, because I want to make sure we have time for this. You know, this is, you know, continues to grind on. There continues to be this kind of mixed messaging out of the Netanyahu government, which is dealing with a variety of challenges, including a Supreme Court ruling the other day mandating an end to the exemption for ultra-Orthodox serving the Israeli military, a very volatile issue that, you know, could bring down the Netanyahu coalition. But then I think, you know, fundamentally for you, as you're looking at this, Netanyahu recently appeared on television, said the initial phase of the war will come to an end very soon, but that does not mean the war will be over. There's no clear plan for Gaza and who administers it. He's kind of walked back from the U.S. ceasefire plan that was an Israeli plan, but not one that Netanyahu has been willing to support. Hamas has said they won't support a ceasefire plan unless it ends the war. So there's still these gaps in this ongoing horrible crisis, and reports that, you know, up to 500,000 people now are again facing famine conditions because of aid restrictions. We all know, you know, how terrible the status quo is. On this question of Gaza, how would you say that the British policy will change under a Labour government? And what will you be looking to do if Labour is able to get into power?
Well, look, we have now long called for this conflict to end. We've called for a ceasefire, and we welcome the Biden proposal and that the global community emphasized through both the Security Council and the General Assembly is that place where this war has to end. And the hostages need to be released. And most definitely the tremendous loss of life that we've seen in Gaza, the huge disproportionate effect on women and children. It just the suffering has got to end and the aid has got to get in. But the truth is, as we've said that and continue to say that and continue to do all we can diplomatically, and of course, if the Labour Party wins, I will be active diplomatically working with partners to bring that about. All of us know that this is in the hands of Hamas and Sinwar particularly, and it is in the hands of the Israeli government. There was a proposal on the table. Israel endorsed it. The UN passed a resolution calling for Hamas to comply. It would be a very negative step if Netanyahu now backtracked on that proposal. But we're now in a very difficult place. It's my hope. And as we head into July, I think there are sort of some signposts here. First, of course, is I know that Netanyahu is scheduled to come to DC to address, I think, both houses. I think that's going to be very important. The Knesset will wrap up. Washington will go into recess. Can we get that ceasefire before that point? I saw that Hamas have come forward with some further asks. Can those be met? The time is now, it seems to me. And I worry hugely about the prospects of escalation in Lebanon, particularly as we head to September and as we head particularly to the inability of the many people who have left northern Israel, southern Lebanon, able to return to their homes. So I think this is a difficult and challenging period. I really, you know, we have to ensure that there's no backtracking on this proposal for peace. But equally, in the end, Hamas and their positioning is going to be very important as we use all diplomatic levers to bring this about. Now, I will aim to be as supportive as I can be to the important international actors here, of which clearly in the Middle East, Qatar, Egypt are playing an important role, but also here, the United States.
So I got just two more questions. One about kind of politics that interacts with Hamas, and then I just want to end on a personal question. So I do want to ask you from the left, a question from the left, David. You make a very persuasive case that I very much agree with about what Labour's done to be able to put itself in a position to win, hopefully, like a very decisive majority. At the same time, you know, there's been kind of a pretty ruthless effort to make sure that nothing interferes with that. And I'm speaking particularly about, you know, there have been a couple of candidates who lost Labour Party support for statements they made, often in conjunction with Gaza, right? So people who said things that were seen as kind of straying too far out of the mainstream. And, you know, you and I have hung out in London. You know the kind of people I'm friends with. I think some of those people would say, well, wait a second. What happened to, you know, David Lammy is a progressive guy. Labour has to stand for certain things. We get you make certain adjustments, but how do you guard against overcorrection, you know, as you are trying to thread that needle, right, between being a principled progressive, as I've always known you to be, and being successful politically? I mean, this issue is obviously the most complicated one to do that on, but kind of what would you say to people who say, you know what, I want Labour to win, I'm a little uncomfortable with the fact that a couple of these candidates are more to the left kind of got tossed overboard, particularly on the Israel-Palestine issue.
Progressive realism. Read my article in Foreign Affairs. Power is important. My political party has been out of power for most of my 52 years on the planet. And for most of the history of the 20th century and the 21st. And so in that 124 years, if you're happy with a philosophical, purist place in which progressives here in the United Kingdom are in power for less than a third of that time, In fact, it might even be less than It's certainly less than a third. It might be just above a quarter of that time. Then fine, let's be purists about this. But I'm afraid we have to be orientated towards the country. We have to be capable of pragmatism. We have to win friends and votes beyond just our tradition. And here in the UK, we have to persuade, if we're to form a government, always when we form a government, we have to persuade a large chunk of Conservatives to lend us their vote in any election cycle. And in those circumstances, overcorrection, you know, if it's overcorrection in order to deliver for people on their health, on education, on an economy that works for working people, on a progressive posture that has us doing all we can on a really challenging geopolitical front, if it's progressive in order to help progress, the sort of progress that brings me here as the potential first foreign secretary of someone of who's the descendant of enslaved people, that's tremendous progress. You can't get there if you're just wedded to theory. And if you're just wedded to a politics that never changes its mind, look, if you want a politics that never changes its mind, then I'm sure, Ben, you can get Jeremy Corbyn to come on. And he doesn't change his mind. And he's pretty uncompromising. But the truth is, we tried that more times than not, and it's failed. It's not delivered. Yeah. And, you know, let me just tell you this. I grew up poor in Tottenham, working class.
Yeah.
And I remember loads of wonderful socialist friends, you know, vote for us, we'll get there. Then we call them champagne socialists. They would then get to the election, lose. And who struggled? Me and my brethren, folk like me, they were fine. So I'm really clear on where we have to be orientated to win an election cycle. And, you know, and I let me just say this, Ben. I don't even got time to say this, but I was in D.C. with both sides, Democrat friends. Of course, there are sister party, many Democrat friends and Republicans. And what I noticed in the Trump opposition, when I spoke to campaign folk, they were really organized. They were on the data. They could show me the stats on African Americans coming over to them, Hispanics coming over to them. That the messaging was clear. Sometimes we progressives, we're harking back to January the 6th, not a forward offer, I say to Democrat friends, and it's not for me to judge, but what I'm saying is we have to be in the mainstream with a forward proposition for most of the country. It's the food on the table. We have to explain things clearly. And sometimes, yes, sometimes we have to put the ideological stuff not to one side, but we have to remember that we have to win office first if we're to deliver.
Well, look, that's a powerful answer. And I just want to end, it sounds not unlike what Barack Obama would say. I want to end with
that's why we're friends.
Question. Yeah, exactly. Now, that's, we met in 2007, canvassing for Obama. I want to end with, as someone who's known you since 2007, knows your story, you know, like you said, grew up poor in Tottenham, baby of the house, came in very young to politics. You, if all goes well, you could be representing the United Kingdom as Foreign Secretary in a couple of weeks. What would that mean to you personally, David? Reflecting on your whole journey, your family, where you've come from, the people you've represented in Tottenham, what would it mean for you to represent the United Kingdom on the world stage?
Well, you know, my dear friend Ben, you know me well enough to ask the kind of question that might make my eyes well up, and so I'm it's a huge moment. It would be a huge moment. I'm thinking of my parents. We call them the Windrush generation, the people that came to this country to help rebuild it after the Second World War, and they came from the West Indies and the Caribbean. They would never have dreamed that a moment like this might be upon us. I'm thinking of the journey of my party. You know, being in the wilderness and having no power is not fun. 14 years is a long, long time. I'm thinking of the remarkable turnaround after 5 years, and what Keir Starmer has done. And I've been at his, you know, right behind him, supporting him all the way. And it has not been easy. It really has not been easy. And I'm also thinking of this tough geopolitical moment where, of course, there is huge rancor on social media, huge bitterness in places. And there have been, of course, tremendous pressures because of this war in Israel, Gaza, particularly. So it will be a tremendous moment if it comes about. It will be an emotional moment. But more than anything else, the joy of seeing progressive politicians walking up that street into number 10, called in by Keir Starmer, turning a page on the rancor, division, and the hopelessness of these last few years, in which so little has been achieved by the British Conservative Party. Oh my God, what a moment. And guess what? It's potentially a progressive moment. We get to work together. Well, let's see what happens in the United States. But with Schultz, with Albanese, with Trudeau, there's a real opportunity, particularly on issues like the climate emergency, to make a difference.
Well, look, we can't wait till July 4th. You know, it's always a fun day here in the U.S., but hopefully it'll be a holiday in the U.K. in the best of sense. So best of luck in the home stretch, David, and look forward to talking to you on the other end after a good result.
Ben, thank you so much.
Okay, so before we get to our interview, I want to go through a couple of stories that we wanted to make sure to check in on because we've covered them before in this podcast. The first is Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder. His legal saga is finally coming to an end after spending 5 years in prison in the UK and years before that in kind of de facto house arrest of sorts, couldn't leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Assange left England on Monday to fly to the Northern Mariana Islands. That's a U.S. territory. Assange did not want to come to the continental United States to face extradition there, but he'll be going to this U.S. territory where he's agreed to plead guilty to a single felony count of illegally obtaining and disclosing national security material as part of a plea deal with the United States. NBC reviewed documents that were filed by the Justice Department and reports that he's expected to be sentenced to 62 months with credit for time served, which means that once he returns to Australia, Julian Assange will be a free man. The National Security Council spokesperson Adrian Watson said, quote, this was an independent decision made by the Department of Justice, and there was no White House involvement in the plea deal decision. Now, the one thing I'd just say about this is, look, I think this is the right decision, whoever made it, because I think Assange, this has run its course. He's definitely paid a price for what he's done. There were difficult precedents in play. I'm not a fan necessarily of all the things Assange did. But I do think that prosecuting him under the Espionage Act in the United States would have sent a bad precedent for potential future prosecution of journalists engaged in more normal journalistic activity. I think Assange has clearly paid a price. And I also frankly think that this was a huge issue in Australia where there was concern about Assange's health, his mental health, his physical health. This is a key ally of the United States. And so this just feels like the right thing to kind of wind this down and wrap it up. And so I think all in all, as good an end to a very complicated and long and winding story as there could be. I also want to just check in on Haiti. The long anticipated Kenyan police force to help stabilize Haiti began to arrive this week, part of a multinational security support mission that's meant to aid the country, which has been ravaged by gang violence. This initial force is 400 officers with 600 more to be deployed later. Other countries have pledged personnel as well. That includes the Bahamas, Bangladesh, Barbados, Belize, Benin, Chad, Jamaica, and Suriname. A lot of B countries in there. The U.S. State Department has committed $300 million to support the mission. Last week, Tony Blinken overrode Republican opposition to release over $100 million in funding. This comes a couple of weeks after Haiti's transitional council appointed a new cabinet and a month after the appointment of a new interim prime minister. We were able to catch up with Port-au-Prince-based journalist Widlore Merencourt, the editor-in-chief of Ayibo Post and contributor to the Washington Post, to hear about how people are feeling on the ground in Haiti right now. Let's listen to that clip.
The gangs are still in control of Port-au-Prince. They kidnapped people. They make it extremely difficult for all sorts of institutions, including state institutions and hospitals and schools. Hundreds of schools are today closed in Port-au-Prince, and you have about 500,000 people left the capital, and tens of thousands of them since, you know, February. This is the situation that the Haitian people are in right now. And we also have still the food insecurity that Haitian people are struggling with. You have half of the country now, you know, food insecure, and hundreds of thousands of people, you know, waiting for some sort of humanitarian assistance.
So, look, I mean, the situation is quite dire, as we've talked about, as you just heard. And the reality is this offers some hope with this new multinational force beginning to arrive. But this can't be the end. It has to be the beginning. In my judgment, in the past, sometimes, you know, something happens. There's a force deployed to Haiti or some aids provided to Haiti and people kind of move on. I think the key here is going to be sustained attention. And this should probably be the beginning of the resources going to Haiti, not at all the end. And so we'll stay on top of this story on the podcast. We hope that the U.S. and other governments stay on top of it as well, because the people of Haiti have definitely suffered far too much.
Years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Race to savings for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the comfort and support you need with a new mattress from Serta. Find the perfect mattress for a deep and restorative night's sleep. Take control of your sleep and save big money on Serta mattresses now at Menards. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and race to savings on more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, I'm very pleased to be joined by Edward Wong, the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times and author of At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Ed, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Ben. Good to be here.
So, you know, I've followed your reporting, obviously, over the years. And to me, it's always interesting when you get to know a journalist by, you know, their work, which is, you know, objective reporting on what's happening in the world, or at least it is when it's good. And then every now and then you get a book that kind of really takes us into the personal story that informs the worldview that made you as a journalist. And I think one of the reasons why this book is so extraordinary, and I definitely recommend it to all of our audience, is it's a remarkable blend of both memoir and reporting. You look into your father's life in communist China, his military service, which took him all over the country, and experience in the PLA. And then you also bring in your own time as a diplomatic correspondent at a hugely consequential moment in China's history between 2008 and 2016, as China was really beginning to assert itself on the world stage, and kind of, you know, the realization in some ways of parts of what Mao was trying to do, but also very different probably than Mao thought it would go. I just wanted to ask to start, how did you decide to kind of write this hybrid book that blended together your father's story, your family story, and your reporting? Was this something that had been kind of brewing inside you for a long time? Or is it an idea that kind of came to you recently? Like, what led you to this approach?
That's a great question, Ben. It had been percolating for a while. I mean, as I say in the book, I didn't know much about my parents' histories when I was growing up in a suburb of D.C. And my father worked very long hours in a Chinese restaurant in Virginia, and I rarely saw him. And it was when I was in grad school studying the history of China, Chinese politics, that I decided to probe more into their lives. And then I learned at that point that he had been a member of the PLA, which was, of course, intriguing. And but that really got put on steroids when I went to China for the New York Times in 2008. At that point, I started traveling to all these parts of the country that I had never seen before, including the county in Guangdong province next to Hong Kong, where my parents had grown up. And I saw, you know, what the environment of their upbringing was like and what the Chinese Civil War and the Japanese occupation must have done to that area. I also went out to the far west and far northwest to Xinjiang, which, as we know, is home to Uyghur and Kazakh Muslims. And I saw the this vast land where my father has served as a soldier and essentially been part of the initial military occupation of Xinjiang when Mao first sent troops out there. And as we know, that military occupation then evolved to other forms of control and into what we hear today now about the internment camps and other such measures.
And I mean, just starting with your father's story, I mean, what did you come to learn about his motivation for being in the PLA? What was, you know, a mixture of pride and disillusionment kind of comes across. But how did you kind of piece that story together and trying to put yourself in the shoes of your father as a young man at such a revolutionary period in China's history?
Yeah, my father grew up in under the rule of the nationalists, the nationalist government, or the Kuomintang, as we know them by. And they were trying to control China at the time when there were warlords and when the Japanese army was invading China. And at the same time, they were fighting off this communist insurgency. The nationalists had policies that led to mass disillusionment among Chinese, including my father. There was huge inflation, lots of poverty. My father saw homeless people in the streets in Guangzhou. And so he really seized on this idea that Mao was pushing, that the communists, once they took over China, would rejuvenate China, would make it a powerful nation once again, and would bring it out of the feudal era and into a much more modern and much more industrialized era so that it could compete with other superpowers. And I think partly what I wanted to show readers in that element of the story was that that there has been mass support for the party from its very early days, and that the sense of patriotism or nationalism in many Chinese it can be very strong, and it is still very strong today, even if some people question some of the decisions made by leaders or by local officials. The sense of patriotism around China, around the motherland, is strong and can be really galvanized by leaders such as Mao or such as Xi Jinping today.
Well, yeah, I want to get into Xi Jinping because you have a really interesting chapter about Xi Jinping's life, and you visit some of the touchstones in Xi Jinping's journey. Obviously, this is not a direct analogy, right? In the sense that Xi Jinping's father was a, you know, relatively important figure in the early Communist Party, and he's now the one-man rule, probably the strongest leader that China's had since Deng Xiaoping, if not Mao himself. But what I was wondering is that Xi Jinping had his father, and then Xi Jinping, you know, had to deal with the fact that, you know, his father was kind of on the outs and, you know, got sent to for re-education. And he emerges on the other end kind of more devoted to the party and to Mao and what and to kind of the Chinese Communist Party's version of Chinese nationalism. Did you at all think about, you know, how do these two families, the Wang family and Xi Jinping, you know, the different journeys that the two families have undertaken, in the sense that to me, it's kind of interesting, you know, everybody's transformed by this massive event, the Chinese Revolution. And here, what is the journey that led Xi Jinping where he landed versus the journey that led, you know, Ed Wang to be the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times?
Yeah, I mean, partly the book talks about, I mean, the theme of the book is contingencies in history and how these huge tides in history push us in different directions, but we all end up intersecting again generations later. And so my father, interestingly, was when he was posted out to Xinjiang, that region, he was working under Xi's father, Xi Zhongxun, ultimately. Like, he was part of the military occupation, and Xi Zhongxun was the party official who was governing the entire northwest region of China, this vast area. And Xi's father, Xi Zhongxun, would then have debates with Mao and other leaders about whether to go hard or whether to loosen up a bit on the policies that they were using to control the Muslims and other ethnic groups out there. So my father was out there enacting the policies that Xi's father was putting into place. Then a generation later, I'm in China reporting on the younger Xi as he starts to impose his forms of control and to shape his vision of authoritarian rule over China at a time when he thinks China has loosened up too much, that the party has become too corrupt in certain ways, that economic liberalization is moving vast parts of Chinese society out of the sphere of party control. And he wants to tighten up on all that, which is leading to the policies you're seeing today. And like his elders, he also feels a huge devotion to the party and to the idea that the party can lead the country into an area where it can rival the greatest superpower in the world, which is, of course, America. And so we see that type of strong nationalistic attitude really taking root with the younger Xi. I think that one of the other things that we see big echoes of, for example, that I felt in my time in China under Xi and that my father felt, is this idea of state security or the national security state. This is something that Xi Jinping has been a big push on recently. He's pushing out propaganda and rhetoric into China, saying we need to root out spies, we need to root out foreign agents, we need to look at what influences from the outside are entering China, undermining it, and undermining the party ultimately. And in my father's time, that was a huge element, starting from the time Mao took over, when there were these campaigns against so-called counter-revolutionaries. And ultimately, this is what led my father on his path of disillusionment, because he realized that the party harbored suspicions about him and his family. His brother was studying in America and eventually ended up working as an engineer for the U.S. military. His parents were business people in Hong Kong. And so the party had a file on him. And even though my father went to the farthest reaches of China and served in the hardest positions for the benefit of the party, the party, in its fears and in its anxiety and in its suspicions of foreign influence, always had these strong thoughts about my father and the potential threat they saw from people like my father. And he was emblematic of many other Chinese who fell under suspicion in those years.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about two places that I think, you know, come across very powerfully in your book that also had a big impression on me. That's Xinjiang province and Hong Kong, where you did a lot of reporting and where obviously your family's history was present. And I'd say important to me because in a sense, it kind of forced me to reckon with, you know, the Communist Party not evolving in the direction that, you know, people like me in the U.S. government were hoping that there'd be this kind of incremental liberalization. I think even at the beginning of the Obama years, you know, Hu Jintao was no liberal at all, but it was kind of a consensus-based system and it was a little less, you know, brute force in terms of dealing with internal dissent. But to take them one at a time, and you describe your own reporting in Xinjiang province, which is quite extraordinary. You got to see things that very few Americans have ever seen in terms of the nature of the repression there, the nature of life there. knowing that your father, you know, had this history there as well. And I guess the way I'd frame the question, Ed, is that I think if you talk to some Chinese officials who might even acknowledge that what they're doing there is pretty brutal, they kind of say, well, it's inevitable. You know, you Americans did the same thing. You know, we ultimately just have to, China's, you know, suffered from division and instability. And if we don't crack down, you know, that could happen again. But you saw it with your own eyes. I mean, how much is this a choice that is in kind of inherent in the Communist Party? Like it dates all the way back to your father's service that we just can't tolerate there being different identities inside of China. So we have to repress people like the Uyghurs. Or how much of this is a guy like Xi Jinping coming in and taking a different course and really cracking down? I mean, how should we think about the treatment of the Uyghurs as, is it something that's kind of inevitable because it's in the DNA of the Communist Party, or is something that's more distinct to choices that Xi Jinping has made?
Right. That's a great question. And I would say that there's, I'll give two answers to that. One is, I think there is a structural problem with governance of China today, which is, and I think the title of my book, I use the word empire and at the edge of empire, that alludes to this, which is the fact that in my idea, China is the last remaining empire of the Eurasian age of empires, when we had empires from the British to the French to the Ottomans stretching across this landmass. And those empires all kept tight control of really diverse populations across vast geographic regions through force. And because when the communists took over, and also the nationalists before them, they strove to keep China in the form of what the Qing Empire was, then there's an inherent drive to use force, I think, to keep these vast areas of different ethnicities, different cultures under control. And so we're seeing what has happened in both Tibet and Xinjiang, as well as in Mongolian areas and other regions. At the same time, there have been these debates year by year, decade by decade in the Communist Party about questions like assimilation. So, for example, even though they believe in keeping troops or large numbers of security officers out in these areas, they don't necessarily at all times want to destroy the identities of the people there. And there have been periods of post-1949 history when people thought, oh, we need to let you know, let them practice Islam in a more robust manner, for example. But there are other times, such as now, when they're trying to eradicate some of the most fundamental practices of Islam among people, such as forcing Uyghurs to eat pork, for example, or not practice fasting during Ramadan, or preventing them from making the Hajj to Saudi Arabia. So like these very fundamental core parts of being Muslim, they're trying to prevent that and to root it out because they think that those accentuate the differences between these ethnic groups and the mainstream Han population that's in the interior of China. So so I think we see this this dynamic playing out over decades as things change. One other thing I would say about Xi Jinping and his views is that he is very fixated on the breakup of the Soviet Union. And we heard him give this in a secret speech to party members right after he took power. And also, as I was reporting this book and talking to some of your former colleagues, Ben, who were in the U.S. government, they told me that when Xi met with Biden, when both were vice presidents in China in 2011, they had a dinner at a hotel in Chengdu in Sichuan province. And in that dinner, Xi emphasized his views on the breakup of the Soviet Union to Biden. And I think he said that China has to ensure that it doesn't happen in its own country. And so in his mind, what that means is keeping tight control of these regions that have very diverse groups. Because as you know, Ben, when the Soviet Union started to, when the central government started to take different policies in Moscow, then many of the Central Asian republics were among the first to declare independence. And those republics culturally share a lot with Xinjiang, their Turkic Muslim regions. And so I think China looks at that and it has great fears of the same thing happening. And Xi especially has those fears.
Yeah, no, I can say, you know, Obama used to have similar conversations with Xi, not just about this piece of it, but also around the idea that, you know, Americans are maybe individualistic, but Chinese are collectivist, and it's the only way to govern China. It kind of leads me to the Hong Kong question, which is, you know, I spent a lot of time in Hong Kong during the protest movement, and to this day, I'm trying to digest that experience. And to understand it, you know, everything the Chinese government does is a message, right? And the kind of total stamping out of any shred of dissent and this kind of willingness to kind of terminate the kind of city Hong Kong used to be, which was this kind of bridge between East and West. How did you write, you know, about your reporting there, and, you know, filled with kind of powerful anecdotes and images of the kind of the dying days of those, what was the kind of last gasp of dissent in Hong Kong? Should we understand that as a Chinese government that is just seeking to kind of consolidate control and, you know, tie up loose ends from history? Or should we see that as the kind of irreconcilability of China with the West? You know, I mean, would that be overreading it? Because, you know, I think to some people, it kind of it felt like a message of, you know, not only do we want to control this area, but we're sending a message that we don't want any of this in our country, any dissent, any diversity. How do you digest Hong Kong based on your reporting and your family's history there?
Ben, the what has happened in Hong Kong touches very personal core to me because my family's roots are in Hong Kong. My parents, my father is born there, even though he spent many years in mainland China, and my mother grew up there. And so, like, we, through my upbringings, I talked to a lot of relatives from Hong Kong about what the city meant, about the about how it was this confluence of Western and Chinese ideas. And I think you've experienced that yourself and know the power of that. And I think that, again, this is a very particular thing, in my opinion. It comes down to Xi Jinping again, because I think in different moments in Chinese history, there have been different approaches to Hong Kong. And let's bring up Xi's father again, Xi Zhongxun. He was sent by Deng Xiaoping, who was the one who started the economic reform era in China, to go down to the south and govern the area of Shenzhen, which, as you know, is the Chinese city right across from Hong Kong. And so at that time, the Chinese leaders were not looking at Hong Kong as a threat to communist rule, but in fact, they were looking to Hong Kong as a model for how China could advance its economy, could adopt some liberal market principles, and then could create boom cities in the south, in places like Shenzhen, the same way that Hong Kong had boomed under British colonial rule. And I think they were also aware enough at that point that Hong Kong wasn't a democracy and didn't have a democracy. It certainly didn't have that under the British. And so they thought that they could create their own model of that, in that there would not be a democratic government in the south, but at the same time, they could allow enough economic principles to flourish there to really drive growth in China. But instead, Xi Jinping has taken a very different direction. And I think what this goes back to his idea of the national security state. It goes back to his idea of fears or paranoia, as some might put it, about foreign influence. And I think that he legitimately believes that places like Hong Kong are these anchors or footholds by Western governments or Western forces that are seeking to undermine China. I don't think he sees necessarily that a lot of the protests are this grassroots movement that have sprung up in opposition to increasing restrictions on Hong Kong. I think in both the public rhetoric that he's put out and in internal party communications, it seems that they legitimately believe foreign forces are the ones that have been stirring up the protests and trying to use Hong Kong as a gateway to introduce ideas into China. To a degree, I can see why they might think that, because the South and Southern China have always been this gateway for foreign ideas into China that have actually led to topplings of governments in Beijing. And the clearest example is Sun Yat-sen, or Sun Zhongshan in Chinese, who was from the South, was from Guangdong province, traveled overseas, came back, and then, and while he was overseas, really catalyzed a lot of the revolutionary ideals that led to the downfall of the Qing Empire.
Well, that leads me to kind of one last question, which is you end the book kind of reflecting on not just, you know, your family and how they've really kind of digested and dealt with and wrestled with and thought about the identity of being Chinese, but also you're obviously this bridge to an American identity. And that raises the question of, you know, that's on all of our minds. You know? And I was just kind of wrestling with this myself and the foreign affairs piece you and I are talking about, which is can the US and China coexist? And a lot in the world, if not everything, depends upon that. It's a huge and impactful question that everyone should kind of care about. What did the experience of writing this book, as well as obviously continuing to report on this relationship, where does that lead you in terms of your assessment of whether and how, frankly, the US and China can coexist given, you know, our respective ambitions? You know, the US is guilty of having pretty imperialist ambitions itself and wanting to control things. China obviously is demonstrating its own version of that behavior. Where do you stand on that, informed by the experience of writing this book?
Yeah, I think that they can coexist in certain spheres. I do think, for example, economic competition is manageable. I think that both countries could probably reach some equilibrium in terms of like how they approach trade. And the U.S. will see its form of capitalism, for example, as a superior one. Although we do see some Chinese influences coming in, such as industrial planning is making a comeback now in Washington, as you know, Ben, or that notion of it. And that's a very Chinese idea of economic growth. And at the same time, China will have to grapple with its system. And then you can see these competing for trade in the world. But the point, I think, where it would be very hard to reconcile the ambitions of these two countries is military dominance in the Asia-Pacific region, an issue that you've thought a lot about, Ben, I know. And I think the problem here is that the U.S. wants to maintain its military edge, its military capabilities throughout the Asia-Pacific. It knows that threats can come from Asia. We all live in the shadow of World War II, and we know what happened with Japan back in that era. And I think the U.S. sees China as a potential version of that darker Japan if Chinese leaders move in a certain direction, which Xi has, you know, because of Xi's policies, then he pushes American policymakers to think that way about China. And so America wants to maintain military dominance there. China, of course, given where it's come economically and given its rapid military buildup, it wants to have military dominance in the Asia Pacific. And that makes sense for a country like China. I mean, it sees itself as a great power, as an imperial power that's reasserting its previous strength. And Asia is in its backyard. So it wonders, why should we be letting American naval ships, American fighter jets have unfettered access to all these areas around us and potentially contain us? It would be like if we saw Soviet ships or Soviet aircraft all around the coastlines of the U.S. in our era. And we know what happened when Cuba became the nexus point for a lot of those tensions. So that's something that I find very hard to reconcile. And I think that this is something that, whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration in power, they'll really have to grapple with in the coming years.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, because China is not going anywhere, it's only natural that it would want a degree of influence in the world commensurate with its size, but that's right now butting up against the U.S. Well, look, Ed, the one thing you can never capture in an interview about a book is the fact that it's really beautifully written. One reason for people to check it out is it's a very, you know, literary memoir. And you'll also, as you've seen from this interview, learn a lot about China. So really, thanks for joining us. Thanks for writing the book. Again, I definitely recommend it to people. It's At the Edge of Empire, A Family's Reckoning with China. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Ben. It's always great to talk to you.
Okay, thanks to David Lammy. Good luck to him and the Labor Party. Thanks to Ed Wong. Good luck, Tommy, with the book release. And one programming note, we will be off next week for the holiday July 4th week. I hope everybody has a great 4th, and we will see you on July 10th.
If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers and other community events, plus find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. And if you're as opinionated as us, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, Ben Rhodes, and Reed Cherlin. Our producer is Alona Minkowski, and associate producer is Ashley Mizuo. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our studio technician is David Tolles. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Phoebe Bradford, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld. Rachel Maddow Presents Ultra, the chart-topping podcast from MSNBC, is back for a second season. Rachel tells an all-but-forgotten true story of an international manhunt for a spy that infiltrated the U.S. Army's war crime prosecutions in post-war Germany, revealing the ultra-right's reach into politics in America. Search for Rachel Maddow Presents Ultra to follow and listen to the series. New episodes drop Mondays. If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.
Race to savings for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the comfort and support you need with a new mattress from Serta. Find the perfect mattress for a deep and restorative night's sleep. Take control of your sleep and save big money on Serta mattresses now at Menards. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and race to savings on more great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards. Save big money on your next painting project at Menards. Pristine Interior Paint and Primer in 1 is Dutch Boy's best hiding and most durable paint. It delivers a smooth, elegant finish while providing maximum scuff, stain, and mark resistance. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and get your painting project started today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save